Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. What practices lead to synergistic leadership? In this episode, Lewis Center Director Douglas Poe interviews Ann Michael about her book, Synergy, a leadership guide for church staff and volunteers.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I'm Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center and your host for this talk. Joining me is Ann Michael, who is the associate director of the Lewis Center and the author of Synergy. Ann, I want to begin, though, asking a couple of questions just on currently sort of what you're reading and who's shaping your thinking on leadership.
Well, I thought you might ask that question. One of the advantages of my work at the Lewis Center, particularly my role as editor of Leading Ideas, is I get to read really widely the literature of church leadership, and we are reading a lot of the new releases in the area of church leadership. So in the past week, I've read three books. I've read an advanced copy of Adam Hamilton's Unafraid, and I've read Small Church Checkup by Kay Cotan and Phil Schroeder, and I've also read a book called Stay in the City, which is authored by people at the City Seminary in New York. One of the advantages of getting to read so many of the newer books is you sort of start to see trends and where ideas are reinforcing one another. If I had to pick favorite books, I'd probably go back to some of the classics. I think books like Leadership on the Line by Heifetz and Linsky or Leading Change by John Cotter have been really influential to me in thinking about how leadership is exercised. But I learn something from every book that I read.
You talked about trends. So on the three books you just read this week, did you see any sort of trends coming out of all three, since they're all sort of very different and the authors are very different?
Yeah, they are three very different books with three very different sets of focuses. But I think if one of them really speaks to a trend that I'm aware of, it would be the Stay in the City book. It's a book about looking at vital flourishing urban ministries in the city of New York and how churches connect with their communities in urban areas. And I think it really reinforces for me a lot of the trends I'm seeing in how churches are having to get outside their own doors and engage with their neighbors in new and very creative ways. So I think that book was probably the most thought-provoking for me in light of the other trends that I'm seeing.
Good. Some in our audience may be interested in also picking it up and reading it. Also, I'm curious of who sticks out as a mentor in leadership for you. You mentioned some of the classical books that stick out on your mind, but are there individuals who stick out as a mentor in leadership for you?
Are you talking personally, or are you talking generically?
Personally.
Well, my goodness. I mean, I certainly have learned so much about leadership from the opportunity to work with Lovett Weems over the last 14 years. He's just taught me so very, very much. I've had the opportunity to be in the classroom with him a lot and to hear him work with groups of clergy, and I've just learned so very much from him. And I think of just a whole collection of people in my local church, some of whom were colleagues when I was on staff there, and some of whom have just been longtime collaborators in various ministry projects. Their dedication and their commitment to leadership I came into ministry leadership in the late 80s and 90s when there really was such a big emphasis on lay involvement, and I really took that lesson to heart, that it's important for lay people to really dig in and lead, and there were a lot of good models of that in my church.
I'm going to be excited to talk to you about lay leadership in a second, but I just want to follow up and ask, can you share maybe one story or one thing that you learned from Lovett that sticks out in your mind?
Well, I think there are so many lessons. The one that comes immediately to my mind is the importance of making well-informed decisions, of really taking the time to gather the data and know the facts. I think so often in my own experience in congregational life, decisions get made just by, you know, the loudest voice in the room or the personal opinions that people express and bring to the table without the sort of systematic dedication to really learning the facts of the situation and consulting research and data. And I think Lovett has really impressed on me in a major way how important it is to pay attention to the numbers, to the facts, to the trends, and make good, informed decisions.
Good. That's helpful. Let us start talking a little bit about this wonderful book you've written, Synergy, a Leadership Guide for Church Staff and Volunteers. I'm curious, why is the term synergy so compelling for leadership?
Right. So, I mean, we all know the word synergy. It really simply just means working together. It comes from the Greek word synergos, which also means working together. But I think what's interesting about synergy is when in common usage, when we use the phrase, it really means something more than just working together. It's this idea that the whole can be more than the sum of the parts, and that when something is synergistic or when people are working together in synergistic ways, their efficacy and effectiveness is multiplied because of this effect that we call synergy. And it's a real phenomena. It happens in the natural world. It happens in the realm of behavioral sciences. It happens in the economic world. But it also happens in the spiritual world. When we come together, we are more effective. And that's because of the nature of our God. I mean, our God is a synergistic God who is found in the interplay between the three persons of the Trinity. Our God is a team player, essentially, and for that nature, synergy really is a spiritual force in our world, and when we learn to behave in synergistic ways, our spiritual impact and our impact as leaders is magnified. And so learning to lead in synergistic ways not only brings us closer in accord with God's plan for how ministry should be conducted, but it also is just plain old more efficient because it allows us to get more done in more effective ways.
I'm a sports fan, so I love that you use sort of a sports analogy. And I'm going to pick up on that for a minute and think about basketball. And in basketball, you know, the teams that are really good have a star player. So if you go old school, you can talk about Larry Bird, Magic Johnson. If you go new school, you'll talk about LeBron James or Kevin Durant. Teamwork is still important, but you still have that superstar. So when you think of sort of synergy and this analogy to basketball, does it hold up? Can you have a superstar and be synergistic, or does it require someone sort of really fitting into the mold a little bit more than sort of the analogy I'm putting before you?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised when you said that I'd used a sports analogy. I used the word team, and I think team happens in a lot of places other than just sports. But to use your metaphor of a basketball team that has a standout player, I think that gets to the question of what the role of different individuals is on a team and what the role of the leader of a team is. What we know about the dynamics of effective teams is that for a team to be truly effective, every person on the team has to play a meaningful role. And well, I don't know nearly as much about basketball as you do. I certainly know that's the case with a basketball team. If one of the players wasn't doing his or her part, that team couldn't really be effective no matter how great the standout star was. And so on a team, it's important that every single member of the team have a well-defined and essential role that they are required to play. And the leader of the team really is the person who facilitates, coordinates the work of the team. So, you know, can there be a standout star on a team? You know, sure. In a good team, people are going to be playing to their strengths. And if someone is particularly gifted at a certain aspect of what they're doing in a team context, you know, certainly they can be a star. But I think where that analogy maybe doesn't apply quite so much in terms of ministry or teamwork is, I think good team leaders are always making heroes of others. That's another phrase that I learned from Lovett. So a good team leader in a church setting isn't just interested in their own stardom of their own achievement. They're also thinking about how they can help others on their team accomplish what they're capable of accomplishing. So can you excel? Can you do well? Absolutely. But not simply because you want to be the standout star, but because you know, you have something valuable to contribute and you want to help make sure that others on the team are able to excel and contribute as well.
I appreciate it. I think that's a helpful answer because oftentimes I think people, when you think of team, when you think of synergy, you sort of think of everyone being equal, and it may mean some people get the concept they have to sort of diminish some of their gifts in terms of contributing. But the way that you have just expressed it really is more about how can all of our gifts come together so that we can thrive in the work that we're doing. And I think thinking of it in that way can be really helpful for individuals when it comes to a team. Let me sort of push on that a little bit and ask, then what are the challenges that you think particularly teams face when they're trying to come together in ministry? So what prevents us from having synergy?
Yeah, so one critical factor in teams is trust. And if there isn't trust on a team, whether that's in the workplace or in the congregation, or I'm sure on a sports team as well, that really prevents a team from working to its maximum potential. And I think that a lot of the literature around team effectiveness actually comes out of the workplace. Not the realm of congregational life. And I think that it's different in the workplace because people spend so many more hours of the week together, whereas in a lot of church groups, you know, maybe you're on a committee or a team that only meets once a month or, you know, and so you may not have as much opportunity to really build relationships and build trust as you would if you were working together on a more frequent basis. And so I think if you are the leader of a church team or a ministry team, thinking about how you can not just get your job done, but help your team really develop, build the relationships that foster the trust that's necessary for good teamwork is a critical success factor.
I'm glad you talked about relationships because you talk about it a lot in the book. And I've observed some people are just naturally relational and others really struggle to be relational. What advice do you have for those who struggle to build relationships?
You are so right about that. There's a chapter in the book where I talk about the power of relationship, and synergy and leadership really is based on relational capital, because getting to know people and getting to understand their interests, their concerns, their passion is part of motivating them. It's part of identifying common interests that people may want to work together on. It's part of getting to know people's areas of giftedness and passion so that they can connect to work in a meaningful way. Some people are just naturally gifted. Some people are extroverts, and it comes very naturally to them to want to get to know people and stay in relationship with them. And other people are more introverted. I'm constantly surprised by the number of self-professed introverts who are in ministry, even though ministry is, by its very nature, I think, very relational work. And for those people, I think they do have to be more deliberate about building relationships. But the good news is I think that there are actually some pretty simple, easy practices that people can do to become more relationally aware. Probably the most important one that I know of, and this comes from work that I've done in the area of community organizing, is just the practice of having one-on-one meetings with people, whether they're newcomers to your church or people in your community, or even people that you are regularly in connection with, but the practice of sitting down periodically with them for a one-on-one conversation for the purpose of getting to know them better, checking in on what's going on with them, finding out what makes them tick, finding out what angers them, what motivates them. It's out of those kind of conversations that we really we figure out who other people are, what their concerns are, ways in which they might want to get engaged with other kinds of activities. We're a lot more likely to support someone, to help someone out if we know them. And so the more people you know, the more people that know you and understand what you're about, the more likely you are to be able to engage them in ministry. And so it really starts at that level of building relationships.
And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're suggesting not only should pastors take the time to do the one-on-one relational building, but also individuals who are lay leaders or involved strongly in lay leadership in general should take the time to invest in one-on-one relational building.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a practice that's not only important for pastors, it's important for any other ministry leaders, whether they're staff leaders or volunteer leaders, that they're building their relational capital by getting to know people.
I really enjoyed one of your subheadings, The Art of Asking. Can you talk a little bit about the art of asking? Why is it important for leaders to be able to cultivate this art?
Yeah, so I have done a lot of work in stewardship ministry. I consider myself a stewardship professional. It was one of my first areas of responsibility in my own congregation, and I've been fortunate that I've been able to continue to focus to some extent on stewardship in my work here at the Lewis Center. I think a lot of what I've learned about how to ask people effectively comes out of the work that I've done in stewardship and fundraising. It's amazing how many people will say to you, "I'll do absolutely anything, but please don't ask me to ask other people for money. I just hate doing that." I probably felt that way early on too. But what I discovered is that when you really care about something deeply, when you care about it enough to support it yourself and give your own time and your own resources to it, why would you not also care about it enough to ask others to also help you with that? And so that's true whether you're asking people for money or whether you're asking people to volunteer or get involved in leadership. And so I think the first real cornerstone of the art of asking is being clear about the importance of what it is that you're asking people to do and being able to express that clearly and convincingly. There's lots of other tips and strategies and techniques that I talk about in that chapter, but I think it's grounded in that clear sense of purpose that sometimes I call the importance of why. It goes back to the why of it.
For those who may not be familiar with sort of this idea of the why, can you say a little bit more?
Yeah, so sometimes I think about three important questions. You can always ask yourself, why is this important to me? Why is it important to our congregation? And why is it important to God? If you can think through the answers to those three questions and communicate them compellingly to someone else, you are going to be more effective in getting that person to support your ministry, whether it's through through financial gifts or whether it's through active participation. And a lot of times when people do asking in the church, it's more, you know, it comes from a place of desperation or just filling needs and not really this deep sense of why it would be important for someone to do what you're asking them to do.
I want to shift gears a little bit, and you know this about me, and I know there are a lot of other individuals like me out there that just do not like meetings because they feel like, you know, really not a whole lot gets done in meetings, and I could be doing so much more work if I were just left alone. What are some suggestions to help individuals like me who feel like their time is being wasted when they're at meetings?
Yeah, well, I know a lot of people share your feeling about meetings, and I've certainly experienced at times meetings as unproductive and boring. But the fact of the matter is, in congregational life, meetings are just part of how we do our work. And I think there's a theological reason for that. I think when the people of God come together in common purpose, that's when the Spirit works among us. And so I've certainly experienced that at many junctures in my own ministry and my own leadership. And so I think we have to learn to see and to make meetings positive and productive venues where we can advance the mission of our church and the mission of God. And so in the book, I have a chapter that I call Mastering Meetings, and it goes through some strategies for making sure that meetings can be as productive as possible. And it, similar to the art of asking, clarity of purpose is really the first principle. Knowing why you're meeting, going into every meeting with a clear so that, as Lovett Weems would say, why are we here, so that we know what we need to accomplish, is really, really critical. Oftentimes, particularly I think church staff meetings, they can get very ungainly because if there's just a time every week when a group sits down together and talks, everybody's bringing all kinds of different agenda items to the table. Some of them might be long-term in focus, some of them might be short-term in focus, some of them might be logistical planning, some of them might relate to long-term strategic planning. What experts in meetings say is that you can avoid that kind of bombardment of lots of different things coming to the table at the same time by having, you know, one meeting that's just for the purpose of check-in, other meetings that are for longer-term planning, and not trying to mix those things around the table. What I found working on a church staff was that often the weekly staff meeting was the only time that people knew that they were going to have the pastor's ear. So they would end up talking about a lot of things that really the whole rest of the group didn't need to be engaged in, but because they knew that this was their one time to raise something with the pastor. Those kind of issues that can be better taken care of between two people don't need to be brought to a meeting. And if that's the communication pattern that a church staff has fallen into, you have to figure out ways to get out of that.
Thank you. That's helpful. I don't know that I'll like meetings anymore, but I appreciate your response.
Well, I'm not sure I always like meetings. I've developed tolerance for them because I know that they're just part of the job.
The other thing that really struck me in the book is you talk about we should assume the best about others. And that really sort of resonated, sort of assuming the best, because I'm not sure that as individuals, no matter who we are and how open we are, that we actually assume the best about others.
Right.
And, you know, it sounds good, but then I started thinking, but how do you practically do that? Because we all sort of just react to individuals in different ways. So how can I assume the best about someone else?
That's a fair enough question, because I think it's human nature for us sometimes to not always see other people in the most favorable light. And this comes from a chapter in the book where I'm talking about conflict and how we engage conflict. I have learned through now 4 decades of church membership where we have been through some conflicts and some situations that have become very polarized, that there's really not much to be gained by vilifying someone else. And so sometimes I have a little mantra that I say to myself if I'm having problems with a person. I will say to myself in my own head, this person is now my new best friend. Meaning that I have to, there's more to be gained in me trying to put myself in their shoes and figure out how to work with them than there is in me trying to, allowing myself to vilify them or be obstructionist in how I deal with them. And it's, you know, listen, we all slip into unhealthy ways of thinking about situations. That's only human nature. But I think, you know, checking your own attitudes is a leadership practice. And I think some of it comes with experience. I really do try to do that. And I try to be mindful of when I, in the drift of conversation, of when I'm aware of other people kind of boxing people in or, you know, assuming the worst of people.
And I'm going to shift directions one more time. Can you offer sort of advice to smaller congregations? So if you're at a church that has a staff, that typically means you're a certain size. Smaller congregations, in many cases, it's the pastor, and then is trying to get volunteers who all are lay people who are often working and only have so much time. So how do you help them to sort of create the synergy that you're talking about in the book when you're when you know you have sort of a limited resource pool?
Yeah. So I want to push back on one assumption in the way you just presented the question. And prior to writing this book, I had undertaken some research to try to figure out what was going on with church staffing trends in the United Methodist Church. And one of the myths, I think, that the research that I did help to dispel was the idea that only large churches have paid staff. But here's what's different. In a mid-sized church or a smaller church, they may still be paying people to do certain things, but they're likely paying them on a very, very part-time basis, maybe to do something 5 or 10 hours a week. Whereas in a larger church, their staff may be legitimately part-time or full-time. So smaller churches are with the trend of more paying more people to do certain ministry roles, so they do have staff. But that's just a little bit of an aside. It is true that congregations are having to rely more both on paid and unpaid lay people to do more of their ministry. And so I think that a lot of what I talk about in the book is actually equally true for someone who is in a volunteer role where they have serious ministry and leadership responsibility, as it is of someone who's in a paid staff role. And getting people involved seriously in leadership is one of the challenges. I know that from the work we do here at the the Lewis Center for Church Leadership, that that's one of the most common issues that presents as people talk to us about their needs, that they need to get more and newer people involved in leadership. They need to get more people involved in volunteering. I think there's two things that I would lift up in relation to that need. One is I think that there's much, there's been a lot written in recent years around what I would call organic approaches to leadership development. That a lot of, if you want there to be new leaders coming up in your congregation, you have to work to bring them up through things like informal mentoring and inviting people to come alongside, through the kind of relational awareness that I was describing a little bit earlier, personal invitation, which is related to the art of asking. And so some of these person-centered, organic ways of getting to know people and getting them connected to what you're doing in an informal way are often more effective ways of getting people initially involved than some of the old-fashioned formal recruiting mechanisms that churches have tended to rely on. You need those formal mechanisms, but the informal, organic ways of connecting people to things are part of that process too. And then, since my background is in stewardship, I often think about us helping people learn how to steward their time. If we went to someone in our congregation and asked them to make their tithe or their offering, and they said, "Oh, sorry, I can't do that. I've already spent all my money," you'd probably be thinking, "Well, I've got to help this person understand that in order to be a faithful Christian steward, they need to be taught how to rethink their priorities and do better budgeting and make giving to God a priority." I think that same logic applies to how people spend their time, but we often don't challenge them to think that way. I experienced this in my own life when some years ago when I committed to a weekly Bible study group, and I had been wanting to do it for a period of time, but I had put off doing it because I just was afraid of the time commitment. I didn't think I had time to do it. But what I found is once I decided to do it, and I set that time aside every week for the Bible study, my other time commitments kind of fell in place around it. And when that Bible study was over at the end of the year, I was ready to re-up and do it again because I'd realized that I actually had more time than I thought I did. To me, that's analogous to someone making a first fruit gift. It's saying, don't wait just to give to God out of what's left over after all the other claims on your life have been satisfied. If you prioritize it, then the other things will fall in place behind it. And so teaching people to think about really analyzing how they spend their time, what it would mean to prioritize serving in the church, is a way of thinking about their time use through the lens of stewardship. And I think there's some room for us to do some more work on that.
Good. And thank you for sharing with us today from your book. Are there any closing thoughts you would like to leave us with?
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. I continue to think a lot about the changing leadership reality in congregations. I think we are beginning to think in more comprehensive ways about the nature of the religious workforce and how that is changing in the nature of ministry and how that's becoming more inclusive and participatory. And that's really what I was bringing to the writing of Synergy, and I hope that's what I bring to my work in leadership overall. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about it.
Thank you. And thank everyone for joining us on Leading Ideas Talks.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Synergy, a leadership guide for church staff and volunteers. As more and more laypersons take on significant ministry roles, many of them are ill-prepared, underappreciated, and confused about their call. Synergy is a leadership guide that speaks directly to their needs. Learn more at churchleadership.com/books. In the next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Director Douglas Poe speaks with Pastor Charlie Reed, author of That'll Preach, 5 Simple Steps to Your Best Sermon Ever, about connecting with more people and engaging your current parishioners more effectively through preaching.
When you get up to preach a sermon, I've always said that it's a mistake to begin with Scripture and say, okay, our Scripture lesson for today is, that's a mistake because you can't assume all your listeners are just dying to hear the passage. First, you have to convince them why this text is important and how it relates to their lives. And then you go to Scripture. You're right. If you begin by assuming they know why or assuming that they're interested, I mean, it's the kiss of death. They're just not going to connect with you. But you have to get everybody on board at the beginning and explain the why.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.